Supreme Court review many years ago. Judge Kelly came upon the idea of having a couple of practitioners who are interested in following bankruptcy law at the sort of national level present to local practitioners on what the Supreme Court of the United States is up to in terms of construing the bankruptcy code and related issues. For many years, Tom Schreiner of the Foley firm and Pete Blaine of the Reinhardt firm had been the presenters. And Pete has decided recently that it might be better to spend his Decembers in warmer confines. And so his natural successor, Frank DeCastri, who's now at the Reinhardt firm, graciously agreed to take Pete's place and work with Tom and jointly present on the Supreme Court, on developments on bankruptcy law in the Supreme Court, and developments that might be in the pipeline of future Supreme Court cases. The outline, as I'm sure everyone is aware, is posted on the court's webpage at the Lou Jones link or page. And without further ado, I will turn it over to Tom and Frank. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chief Judge. I have had the privilege of doing this since it got started. I'm trying to remember when it started, a long time ago. I think this was Judge Kelly's idea back when she originated the idea of Lou Jones breakfast shortly after Lou died way too young, and we wanted to do something to honor him. And in the days when these were actually associated with being present in a room in the courthouse and having breakfast. That didn't last long. We continued to do it without breakfast and with people participating remotely from outside Milwaukee, but the Milwaukee people were still expected to come into the courtroom. We did this for many years. What the idea of it was is probably something like what Judge Halfinger has said. Another thing to talk about, we pay attention to the Supreme Court. They get to, you know, tell us what the law really means. And occasionally they do. People wonder sometimes whether the Supreme Court actually cares what goes on in bankruptcy court. And at some level, maybe it doesn't. But, you know, it's a great, the bankruptcy code itself, not so much the rules, which in theory the Supreme Court could change anytime it wants to because it's adopted them to begin with. But the code passed by Congress is one of these situations like the Internal Revenue Code. It's all in one book, you know. In theory, you could learn it all. And the cases are cases that seldom get that far up. You know, there's a certain ephemeral character to bankruptcy court litigation. Most of the time, nobody has the time or the money to want to litigate long enough to get an issue up three stages above the bankruptcy court into the Supreme Court to get a question answered. And of course, the Supreme Court at one level doesn't care what goes on in bankruptcy courts at all because it doesn't review bankruptcy court decisions. It reviews decisions of the Court of Appeals, the courts of appeals. And so it's got to come up. And as a practical matter, unless it's a matter of great significance on its own, one of the cases we'll talk about today being one of those, it requires that there be some conflict that has developed among the courts of appeals on an issue of bankruptcy law, always statutory, because all bankruptcy law is statutory, in order to get up there. And then, you know, that there's enough of a division and there's something sufficiently interesting and important that ought to be resolved that the Supreme Court will take it up. Pete and I always did these things in the morning in November. Now we're at noon in December, but that's, you know, this is COVID time and lots of things have changed. I was glad when Frank, my longtime partner who left us a few years ago and is now over at Reinhardt, was willing to take on, uh, uh, to take over Pete's spot. So we'll start today. You never know what you're going to have in the Supreme Court. There were two decisions since the last time we gave this talk, or Pete and I gave this talk last year, two decisions from the Supreme Court that have come down. There should have been a third because the Supreme Court granted certiorari and in the fullness of time, in the ordinary course, I should say, would have decided it before the end of the 2019-2020 term, which is to say by last June or July. But it didn't because COVID intervened. The oral argument in the City of Chicago versus Fulton case got pushed off into the fall of this year. It will, I'm sure, eventually get decided this year. It's an interesting case, probably the most interesting case we would have talked about today. But we'll have to wait till next year to talk about what the Supreme Court did with it. That isn't going to stop us from talking about it, though, because we always talk about cases that are going up. And that one's up. It's been argued even. So with that in mind, Frank, you want to say a few things about what we're not going to talk about?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be here and happy to do this with you and to follow in Pete's footsteps. I know you guys have been doing this for a long time. As Tom mentioned, there were not many bankruptcy cases to discuss at Supreme Court. There are a couple decided last term. I don't believe they've accepted cert on any new cases this year. There are about four bankruptcy-related cases pending, petitions for cert pending. I'll just briefly mention them without getting into them. One involves a homestead exemption. Another involves a discharge issue and something related to an implied repeal of the Federal Arbitration Act. Another is, yeah, exactly. another is a willful and malicious injury issue under Section 523 of the code. And the last is a preemption question that arises out of a fraudulent transfer case. So we won't discuss those today, but thought we should mention them. All of that said, I think you'll see that we have plenty to fill an hour here. So without further ado, Tom, I think you're going to talk a little bit about the Puerto Rico decision right from last term and kind of a less frequent opportunity to discuss constitutional issues in the context of a bankruptcy case.
Yeah, the case that Frank is referring to is the one called Financial Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico versus Aurelius Investment LLC, in which the First Circuit managed to make the Supreme Court decide something it probably would have preferred not to decide, but because of the resolution of the First Circuit, it had to. And the issue in this case was whether members of this Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico were officers of the United States, as a term of art, comes from the Constitution. Because if they're officers of the United States, then the question would be, did their appointment to that position require Senate confirmation under the Appointments Clause of the Constitution? We've all been listening to talk about the Electors Clause lately, but there's an Appointments Clause too. Or were they instead their appointments governed by the Territorial Clause of the Constitution, which lets Congress make all needful rules and regulations respecting U.S. territories? And of course, Puerto Rico is not technically a territory, but there we are. This started because back in the first decade of this century, certain tax advantages that had previously been led major businesses to invest in Puerto Rico expired. Why some genius in Congress didn't think about that and realize that there would be a mess if those tax advantages went away and there would be consequences to that, we don't know. But many industries left the island and there was a substantial out-migration from Puerto Rico to the mainland. Puerto Ricans are native-born Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens at birth and therefore can come to New York or Miami whenever they want to, or anywhere else, but that's where a lot of them go. The public debt Puerto Rico's governments and its instrumentalities, utilities and other such instrumentalities, rose from $39 billion in 2005 to $71 billion in 2016. Puerto Rico couldn't service the debt, couldn't restructure it because there is no bankruptcy provision applicable to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is not, Puerto Rico, I should say, like a state, is not eligible for Chapter 9. And yet the existence of federal bankruptcy law was held to invalidate Puerto Rico's own local debt restructuring statutes. Puerto Rico had passed some laws basically trying to do away with some of its obligations to particularly bond lenders. And that was not permitted. So Congress in 2016, showing that it had a sense of humor, enacted the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act. That was, it had that name so that it could spell out, the acronym could be PROMESA, a promise in Spanish, and deal with, I guess, either the promise of the future or the promises that Puerto Rico had made, which it now wanted to get out of. But the act allowed Puerto Rico and its entities to file for federal bankruptcy protection, but not on its own. Congress didn't trust Puerto Rico to do it on its own. It provided the statute for the appointment of a 7-person board, 6 of them to be appointed by the leadership of the House and Senate, which I take to mean in each house, 2 of the majority party got to appoint and 1 of the minority, 1 of them appointed by the president, but none of them confirmed by the Senate because the statute didn't provide for that. That board had the responsibility of proposing a plan to adjust Puerto Rico's financial obligations. And it was given the authority, and the only one given the authority, to file bankruptcy petitions for the Commonwealth and its instrumentalities. The law provided that the board would not be considered a department of the federal government and that the board would be funded solely by Puerto Rico. It's within the territorial government of Puerto Rico, but it's not subject to the authority of the governor or legislature of Puerto Rico, something that, as we'll see briefly, Justice Sotomayor thought was itself unconstitutional. The board filed bankruptcy petitions for the Commonwealth and eventually for 5 of its entities. It proposed restructuring plans that would eliminate $18 billion of bond debt and $45 billion of unfunded pension liability. And the bondholders and the pension plan moved to dismiss all these proceedings, claiming that the actions of the board were invalid because the board member's appointment violated the appointments clause. Now, these cases were filed in the, because the statute so provided, in the District Court of Puerto Rico, a federal district court, Article 3 court. Again, because the statute so provided, none of the sitting district judges in Puerto Rico could handle the case. Rather, the Chief Justice appointed a federal district judge from the Southern District of New York to sit in the District of Puerto Rico for the purposes of these cases as a judge of that court. And the bondholders filed their motion to, bondholders in the pension plan filed a motion to dismiss all of these proceedings because of their invalidity of the appointment of the board members. And the district court denied the motion, holding that the board members were territorial officers and not officers of the United States. Because Puerto Rico lies in the First Circuit, the appeal from this New York judge sitting in Puerto Rico went to the First Circuit, and it ruled that the board members were officers of the United States and that they were subject to the appointments clause, and that since they had not been, 5 or 6 of them had not been appointed by the president and all of them had not been confirmed by the Senate, the board was illegally appointed. But the First Circuit said the board was acting under color of authority. And so the First Circuit invoked something called the de facto officer doctrine, which essentially says that public officers who are illegally appointed or invalidly appointed, nevertheless, would generally have their acts upheld. And in this case, that the judicial decisions made by the judge whose jurisdiction was invoked under this statute by the unlawful board couldn't be attacked on grounds that an unlawfully sitting judge was presiding. But the First Circuit stayed its ruling for 90 days to allow the president to appoint and the Senate to confirm the board members in accordance with the appointments clause. You can imagine, particularly those of you who remember what happened when Northern Pipeline was decided and the U.S. Supreme Court found the new bankruptcy code invalid, unconstitutional, but stayed enforcement until, I think, a few months, until Christmas or something, to allow Congress to do something. Well, Congress didn't do anything. Congress didn't do anything in this case either, but the stay was extended, I think, by the Supreme Court ultimately until it made its decision. So the Supreme Court's decision was unanimous, and it reversed the First Circuit and sent it back. Justices Thomas and Sotomayor, from different ends of the spectrum, filed concurring opinions. But the court's holding, joined in by everyone, was that the Appointments Clause governs the appointments of all officers of the United States, including those located in Puerto Rico. And to this point, they pointed to the historical practice when we had a lot of territories, as the United States was expanding west across the North American continent, of requiring presidential appointment and advice and consent of the Senate for territorial governors. In Wisconsin, for example, back in those days, of course, those weren't life jobs. They were appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. But there are two provisions in the Constitution that empower Congress to create local offices for both the District of Columbia and for the territories, including by statute, Puerto Rico, even though it's not a territory. And the point is, again, proven by longstanding practices throughout the 19th and 20th centuries of creating local offices for the territories in D.C. that are filled through election or local executive appointment. D.C. elects its mayor and its city council, which in some respects has many of the powers of a state legislature and a governor. The clause's term, the court said, officers of the United States, has never been understood to cover those whose powers and duties are primarily local in nature and derived from these two constitutional provisions. And the court pointed out that the statutory responsibilities of this board consist of primarily local duties, representing Puerto Rico in the bankruptcy proceedings and supervising aspects of the Commonwealth's fiscal and budgetary policies. Therefore, the court said they're not officers of the United States. The Appointments Clause doesn't require that the board members be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And therefore, of course, the court didn't need to address the de facto officer issue raised by the First Circuit. Justice Thomas's concurrence, with which I have some sympathy, was that the inquiry whether an officer's duties are primarily local or federal isn't very helpful, tough to apply. Justice Sotomayor went on at some length to say that although acknowledging that her issues weren't properly presented in these cases, she was doubtful that Congress can constitutionally exercise authority to establish territorial officers in a territory like Puerto Rico, where Congress itself had seemingly ceded that authority long ago to the Commonwealth, which of course elects its governor and legislature. So interesting, not much practical applicability in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, but it's good to know we got rules. Frank, you wanna talk about the other case the court decided during last term?
Sure, and just one comment, just lest the materials be unclear. In terms of the appointment of this Oversight and Management Board, they are all appointed by the president. One is appointed, selected by the president in his sole discretion. The other six are selected from lists that are submitted by the leadership of the House and Senate. So,
from which he was required to appoint. He couldn't.
Yeah, that's correct. Yep. Yep.
I want to make sure. This was Obama. It was not Trump who did it, although I don't know whether any vacancies were filled in the meantime.
So the next case we're going to talk about is Ritson Group versus Jackson Masonry. And this is
actually a bankruptcy case.
In an actual bankruptcy case, and one presents an issue that comes up quite a bit in bankruptcy cases because of the unique nature of litigation in a bankruptcy case. The issue, stated succinctly, is whether a bankruptcy court order denying a request for relief from the automatic stay is a final order within the meaning of Title 28, Section 158. Pretty simple facts here. There was a real estate contract between Ritson and Jackson. Ritson thought Jackson had breached the contract and sued Jackson in state court. Jackson filed a bankruptcy petition shortly before trial, and Ritson promptly moved to lift the automatic stay. That was denied. Ritson, at the time, did nothing to appeal the entry of that order. But Ritson did decide to file an adversary proceeding against Jackson. That case was tried, and the court actually ruled against Ritson and found that it was Ritson that breached the contract. So
following issue of why it's a good reason to lift the stay and stay on a bankruptcy court if you're a creditor, right?
I think that's right. So Ritson now decides it's going to appeal the adverse judgment from the adversary proceeding, but also tries to appeal from the order, earlier order, denying its request for stay relief. The district court concluded that the first appeal, the one relating to stay relief, was untimely, and the second appeal was rejected on the merits. Ritson continued its efforts and went to the Sixth Circuit, which affirmed and concluded, using the language of Section 158, that cases are different from proceedings, and held that an order denying stay relief is final and can be appealed immediately. So this goes up to the Supreme Court. With the decision was written by the late Justice Ginsburg. It was another unanimous decision. The context, sort of the background here, is not long before this decision, the Supreme Court had issued a decision in a case called Bullard versus Blue Hills Bank, which is cited in the materials. And that case dealt with the finality of an order denying confirmation, not approving or granting confirmation, but denying confirmation of a Chapter 13 plan. And the court concluded in that case that was not a final decision, because an order denying a plan, confirmation of a plan, does not conclusively resolve the relevant proceeding.
It's like denial of a 12B6 motion in a civil action. Granting one leads to the dismissal of the case. It's a final judgment. You can appeal, but denying it doesn't. So
that's right.
That's it. No.
That's right. Court concluded that only plan approval actually fixes the rights and obligations of the parties. So the majority of circuits to have considered this question had already concluded, by the time this case reached the Supreme Court, that orders denying WIF stay requests were final and immediately appealable. As bankruptcy lawyers know, bankruptcy litigation is not always the same as ordinary civil litigation, particularly when it comes to the parties that are involved, the various proceedings and procedures that can be used for resolution of disputes, discovery, and so on. In ordinary civil litigation, an order is final when the decision terminates the action. or ends the litigation on the merits and really leaves nothing left to do except execution on the judgment. Bankruptcy cases, as all of you know, are a series of controversies often. You've got contested matters, you've got adversary proceedings, you've got separate proceedings for discovery, such as Rule 2004 requests and so on. And in bankruptcy cases, orders are final when they dispose, definitively dispose of discrete disputes within the broader bankruptcy case. So the court held, not surprisingly, I think, that the denial of stay relief does dispose of a procedural unit.
Okay, so this is
anterior to and separate from the claims resolution proceedings in the broader bankruptcy case. Interestingly, the court did issue a word of caution, perhaps fearing too many appeals or something. The court did not want bankruptcy courts to define proceeding to include disputes over minor details of how a bankruptcy case is going to unfold. So she did leave with that that note. Interestingly, there was a Seventh Circuit decision that came down this year, and it came out actually 2 months after Ritson, but for some reason doesn't cite Ritson at all, is a very similar question of finality of a bankruptcy court order. This is the Hazleton decision that we discuss in the materials, and it touches on a couple of the other issues and cases that we're going to talk about today. So I thought it particularly appropriate to include here. Hazleton completed her degree at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, but failed to pay her tuition bill. And so UW-Stout, as universities maybe are prone to do, decided to withhold her diploma. The Hazletons later filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy and obtained a discharge. Apparently, while the bankruptcy case was pending, apparently did not seek the assistance of the bankruptcy court to try to obtain the diploma, which, based on current law in this circuit, was probably a mistake. And Tom will talk about that, our experience before the Seventh Circuit on that precise issue in a moment. So despite
Mike, I think somebody, Mr. Nixon, perhaps, has unmuted his mic. I mean, people should have their mute buttons on. Thanks.
There we go. So despite knowledge of the discharge, the university intercepted the debtor's tax refund, paid themselves, and
how'd they do that? I wondered about that.
That I don't know.
I'd like to figure out how to intercept my debtor's tax refund sometime. That would be useful.
That's probably a Doug Mann question. He could probably answer.
Doug would just have a receiver do it. Yeah. Right.
So university thereafter grants the degree. But then the Hazletons decide to reopen their bankruptcy case and ask the bankruptcy court to sanction the university for collecting their tuition debt after they had received the discharge. Well, the bankruptcy court kind of reached a conclusion on a different legal issue, decided that the debt was non-dischargeable student loan, and therefore the discharge injunction wasn't violated. The district court, on the other hand, on appeal, reversed and concluded that the debt was not a student loan, therefore not accepted from the discharge injunction, and then remanded the case back to bankruptcy court for further proceedings on the question of the violation and the issuance of the requested sanctions. The university, not content with that, decides to appeal immediately. And so the case goes to the Seventh Circuit, which, as it is required to do, examines its jurisdiction as a first order of business, and concluded that the court did not have jurisdiction. citing the Boyard decision, which we talked about in the Ritson context, Seventh Circuit held that the dispute between the Hazeltons and the university is really whether sanctions are warranted for violations of the discharge injunction, and if so, in what amount. The district court's order, of course, didn't finally resolve that dispute. It did resolve the discrete issue, but not that dispute, which left several non-ministerial issues to be decided by the bankruptcy court. And so dismissed for want of jurisdiction. Interestingly, the Seventh Circuit did comment here, picking up on a recently decided Supreme Court decision in Taggart, which we'll discuss if we have time, that upon remand, the bankruptcy court is going to have to determine whether the university had an objectively reasonable basis to conclude that its conduct was lawful despite the discharge order sitting around there. So an interesting case to talk about, not just because of Ritson, but also because it's going to touch on a couple of issues that we're going to talk about now, including college transcripts. Right, Tom?
Right. So
before we gentlemen. Hi, this is Mike.
Wait. Before we get to that, are you gentlemen going to talk about footnote 4 of Ritson, which is not, of course, the most famous footnote in the annals of Supreme Court jurisprudence that's reserved for Caroline Products. But I do find footnote four of Ritson to be an interesting, to present interesting issues, especially since the as I understand, the objection, the 362D motion in Ritson seems to have been based on a good faith issue or a bad faith issue, if you will. Something that seems to me that potentially to be recurring and not to be necessarily limited in scope, that issue at least. So I'm interested to know about footnote four. And footnote four, for I guess everybody's information who aren't sitting there with the decision in front of them, footnote four of the Supreme Court of Ritson said, we do not decide whether finality would attach to an order denying stay relief if the bankruptcy court enters it, quote, without prejudice, close quote, because further developments might change the stay calculus. Nothing in the record before us suggests that this is such an order. Now, you know, one might humbly suggest that changing the stay calculus is something that happens with some frequency when it comes to decisions on motions for requests for relief from stay, because even if the decision is based on things other than an alleged lack of good faith, is the more traditional matters of whether or not there's adequate protection or cause in some other determination, or whether or not the property is necessary for an effective reorganization, or the debtor has equity in the property. You know, those things can change as the case progresses. And so, you know, what does this mean for any order that happens to say without prejudice, or what does it mean for any order in which the calculus changes over the course of the litigation of the bankruptcy case?
Frank, I'm glad you got this one, Frank.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is, I think we don't know what it means yet. You're absolutely right. It poses those questions and issues. I think it gives the bankruptcy judge an interesting power, if you will, to decide whether to make the order without prejudice or not. And there are a lot of things that I think could go into that that calculus, in particular, whether the bankruptcy judge wants an appeal to mess up the rest of the bankruptcy case at that particular moment in time. So it will be interesting to see how that develops. And I wonder, you know, most orders that are issued, in my experience, on automatic stay questions like this are not, or lift stay rather, are not, the bankruptcy judges don't necessarily say with or without prejudice. They simply enter the order and say denied. I would think at a minimum, more attention would be paid to that language in an order going forward.
So I don't know.
So wait, this has become like the like finality under Johnson system, where it's final if the apparently if the circuit court puts in the orders, this is final for purposes of appeal, but it's otherwise not final. I didn't think that that was, I didn't necessarily appreciate that that was how the federal system worked.
And I'm not sure the state system, which has that rule, works, because in my experience, judges will sign whatever you put in front of them, and often will sign two or three of those. This is final for purposes of appeal in the course of the case if somebody asks them to. I don't think that's the rule. It reminds, I don't know this answer at all, and I've never read footnote 4. I was so taken with footnote 13 of Caroline Products that I didn't read footnotes anymore after that. But this just reminds me of the 1291 issue in civil litigation, a dismissal without prejudice is often not a final decision, but it's still appealable if it is like on a jurisdictional issue. You can appeal the denial of jurisdiction. And what's it mean to deny a lift stay motion without prejudice? I mean, the creditor is there saying, let me get at my collateral. And the judge says, no. What do you mean without prejudice? I mean, sure, things may come up again and you may want to come back and tell me things are different. To me, it seems to me like some overbright law clerk in Justice Ginsburg's chambers came up with this theoretical issue that I just can't imagine happening in the ordinary course. If you've been denied relief from the stay, it seems to me, and the denial of relief from the stay, Taggart tells us, is final. It seems to me, if you better appeal it and at least make somebody else decide that, well, maybe she'll change her mind. I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me to be a pretty goofy thing. Anyway.
That seems right to me as well. And even in the situations that you're describing, Judge, where circumstances can change, seems to me in most of the cases that the question presented is based on the facts currently presented to the court, the current situation, do you have a final order? And I think in almost all instances, or at least most, it is going to be a final order.
So just for fun, I have another question. One of the brilliant things, of course, which I say somewhat, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, perhaps not, that Congress did in 2005 when it made the 2005 changes to the bankruptcy code was to provide in Section 362C that the stay terminates for individual debtors who had a case dismissed within, at least one case dismissed within the preceding year after 30 days, unless the debtor shows within that 30 days that they filed the case in good faith, in which case then the court could order the continuation of the 362A stay beyond that 30-day period. So is the order either granting or denying a request to continue the stay more than 30 days? Does that also fit within this paradigm that that's a final order that needs to be appealed? Should anybody be so interested in doing so?
I sure don't know. Frank, why don't you answer?
Thanks, Tom. I think the answer is I don't know. I have dealt with that issue before, Michael, though I don't do much in the consumer context. And it seems to me that that kind of an order is, and maybe you'll argue the opposite side, but is just as final for all the reasons as stated in Ritson as the kind of order that was at issue in Ritson. So if it again resolves that discrete issue and the overlying the overarching bankruptcy case, seems to me you've got to appeal.
Unless it says without prejudice.
Yeah, and that's where you come in.
All right, we can move on.
All right.
Thank you, sir. Where am I here? I want to look at this. Yeah. We're talking a little bit about the city of Chicago versus Fulton. That was a case that was argued just 2 months ago. We're waiting for the decision. It arises out, and the issue is, does an entity that retains possession of property of a debtor's estate have an affirmative obligation under the code's automatic stay 362 to return that property to the debtor or trustee immediately following the bankruptcy petition? That would seem odd if you weren't a bankruptcy practitioner. So Chicago is apparently financing its municipal operations largely by seizing people's cars and holding them until they pay ransom for them. Parking tickets, running red lights, which you get caught on when you're not paying attention because there's a camera and so on. But the municipal laws in Chicago authorize the city to impound a car for multiple determinations of municipal liability. And once impounded, the vehicle is subject to the city's statutory possessory lien and the amount of the unpaid fines. So this is a bunch of cases that came up from the Northern District, naturally. All four of the debtors had their vehicles impounded shortly before they filed bankruptcy. And in each case, of course, they went into bankruptcy court to get their car back. That's what you do in Chicago. Chapter 13, the bankruptcy court found that by not returning a vehicle to the debtor upon post-petition request, the city violated 362A3 and should be sanctioned. In none of the cases did the debtors commence proceeding for turnover under 542. Similarly, in none of the cases did the city file a motion for adequate protection of its interest under 363E, both of which the code provides for. And on appeal, the city asked the Seventh Circuit to overrule its 2009 decision in Thompson, which had established a rule that the act of passively holding on to an asset constitutes exercising control over it, and that such action violates 362A3 of the Bankruptcy Code. Any act to obtain possession of property of the estate or property from the estate or to exercise control over property of the estate. The Seventh Circuit refused to overrule Thompson, reaffirmed it in every respect, while concluding that the city violated A3 and should be sanctioned for refusing to return previously seized motor vehicles. And the Seventh Circuit affirmed the lower court decisions, focusing its inquiry on the meaning of the phrase exercise control. It cited bankruptcy's purpose to group all of the debtor's property together so he may rehabilitate his credit, pay off his debts, and analyze the legislative history of 362. The Seventh Circuit also concluded that 362A3 is effective immediately upon the filing of a bankruptcy petition and doesn't require a debtor to first bring a turnover action under 542. And so here part of the concern that gets played in on this appeal is that 542A, that except as certain things, an entity other than the custodian in possession, custody, or control during the case of property that the trustee may use, sell, or lease, or that the debtor may exempt, shall deliver to the trustee and account for such property or the value of such property, unless such property is of inconsequential value. So, there is a bankruptcy rule that seems to suggest that getting a turnover order requires an adversary proceeding. That is something the debtors don't want to do. It takes time, costs money. So the position that the debtors have taken here is, and if the Seventh Circuit affirmed, was that it's an automatic turnover requirement in 542, and that the burden is on the creditor to go into court to seek adequate protection under 363E of its interest, and that those work together. So the court says creditors lose. The petitioner's position, that is the city, says that that plain text stays acts that alter the status quo. It says stay. It doesn't say go. Stop, not go. Stop doing something. It doesn't require anything affirmative. It doesn't require such acts. The city also says that the debtor's position doesn't comport with the role of the automatic stay. History confirms that 362A3 does not compel creditors to turn over lawfully repossessed property. The debtor's interpretation would render the turnover provision superfluous. The debtor's interpretation would deprive secured creditors of their statutory defenses to turnover under 542, such as I need adequate protection. Therefore, here the city had good faith defenses. The petitioner also argued that reading 362A3 to compel turnover would be inconsistent with the court's decision in Strumpf, Bank of Maryland versus Strumpf, where the Supreme Court some years ago held that just holding on to money that is in a bank account, which is of course a debt that the bank owes to the credit, that the bank owes to the debtor, is not a violation of the automatic stay. The respondent had a different view. Frank, you want to talk about the respondent's position?
Sure. Before I do that, I want to make mention of something, and that is that it's important to remember in cases like this, these City of Chicago cases, or even in the college transcript cases, and Tom will talk a little bit about our experience before the Seventh Circuit in that regard in a moment, that the creditor's position is not entirely sympathetic. Some might say hardly sympathetic. In the college transcript context, the creditor is typically withholding the diploma of the debtor that is trying to get the degree that will perhaps allow him or her to escape the financial difficulties that they've found themselves in the first instance. Also true in the context of a creditor seizing a debtor's motor vehicle, and in many of these cases, it came up in the oral argument for the Supreme Court, where the debtor often needs the car to get to work to pay the creditors that the debtor is trying to pay in a Chapter 13 case. All of this, particularly for the city and these car impoundment cases, are make the city very unpopular. There was mention of it at the Supreme Court oral argument. It might fall under the category of taxation by citation, where municipalities are sort of filling in budget gaps by strictly enforcing these kinds of municipal statutes, speeding and parking and so on. So important to remember just how, what an uphill battle these creditors are often facing here. And it certainly provided for some interesting fireworks in Tom, our college transcript case, me before Judge Martin, and you in front of the Seventh Circuit. But the respondent's position on this is that the majority rule, which the Seventh Circuit followed here, is consistent with 362A3's text and its context and purpose within the code. And there's a lot of discussion here of policy-oriented things, such as the whole idea of consolidating the debtor's estate, bringing all the assets in so that they can be distributed to the creditors.
That assumes, of course, that the Chapter 13 is going forward, and that once the debtor gets his car back, he doesn't dismiss it, which happens in, surprisingly, a significant number of cases, because... Yes. You file a Chapter 13 to get your car back. Beyond that, right. You don't care, right?
That's right. And that was one of the points made at oral argument and in some of the amicus briefs for sure. The respondent also says 362A3 should be read in the context of 542. The idea is they work together. Some might say there's a lot of overlap according to the respondents, but they do different things. In any event, they all work together. There's a turnover requirement that's automatic. You can do it under 362, and it's less burdensome because you don't have to file the adversary proceeding, or you can do it under 542 if you choose to go that route. Together, they protect the bankruptcy court's exclusive jurisdiction over estate property. That's essentially what they're saying. They also argue that the decision is consistent with Strumpf. There were some differences between the code sections that were at issue in Strumpf as well, but they say they were consistent. You had a bunch of amicus briefs, amici, that are out there. I think some of these, including, for example, Professor Ralph Brubaker of the University of Illinois, who has written on this subject extensively. You have the ACLU got involved, National Association of Bankruptcy Trustees, and so on. And they helped spell out a lot of the context of this decision or the question before the court, in particular, some of these policy issues that we're talking about. Tom, I don't know if you feel the need to go into those in any more detail.
I don't know.
Okay. If not, then I'll get into the oral argument. The case was argued middle of October, October 13th of this year. So I think Tom and I were kind of hoping that the decision would have issued by now. Should be coming down soon, one would think. I broke it down into about four different themes that emerged from the oral argument. You had on the one hand, you had a guy named Thomas Goldblatt arguing for the city of Chicago. And then I think the United States also had time for its argument, which had appeared as an amicus, a friend of the court. And on the other hand, you had
in support of Chicago.
In support of the city, that's right. And on the other hand, you had former Chicago bankruptcy judge Eugene Weedoff arguing on behalf of the Chapter 13 debtors. So the first theme is really how far do these words and phrases act and exercise control really go? So you've got Roberts right out of the gate, Justice Roberts asking, you agree that exercising control maintaining possession it constitutes exercising control. And you got Justice Thomas didn't agree with that, made a point of it a couple of times, thought that mere possession is not exercising control. But then asking questions like, well, would the code prevent you from disposing of the cars after the bankruptcy case is filed? Justice Alito, what happens if the cars are moved to another lot? What does that do? Justice Sotomayor, what happens if the vehicles are damaged while they are in the city's possession? That's really kind of the first theme. And certainly you would expect them to decide this question and what do these words and phrases mean, particularly when interpreted together. Second theme is something we touched on before, which is turnover motions being brought by motion or by adversary proceeding. The way the bankruptcy rules are written right now, it appears to require an adversary proceeding. And Justice Sotomayor in particular was very concerned about that, that the amount of time that it will take a debtor to bring one of these proceedings, the money that it would take. And meantime, the secured creditor is sitting there watching all this happen while keeping the debtor's car. That's something that clearly bothered her. I think this opens the door for a potential compromise of sorts. As Tom mentioned, Supreme Court can change the bankruptcy rules and perhaps would consider a change to the rules that would allow turnover proceeding to be commenced by motion. It'd be interesting to watch what they do there. Third theme, which I think really gets to the heart of the questions of statutory interpretation that are issued here, is comparing sections 362 and 542, there appeared to be some common ground among all the justices that there's a real problem with the statutory interpretation being proposed by Judge Weedoff on behalf of these debtors. As Justice Roberts said,
you should tell them what Judge Weedoff heard from Justice Gorsuch, which he probably hadn't heard when he was a judge.
So Gorsuch asked a very pointed question about, I think he was asking at the time about, well, why didn't, in 1984, when Congress added the exercise control language to this section of the code, why didn't Congress, if this is what it wanted to do, add words to the effect that retaining possession of property of the debtor would be a violation of 362A3. And Weedoff kind of said, well, Justice Gorsuch, I'm not really sure I understand the whole question. And this was probably the most amusing moment of the argument. Gorsuch said, well, I am sure you do, my friend, and then proceeded to ask the question again. So
anybody who knows Judge Weedoff would know that he surely did understand the question. He didn't want to answer it.
Correct. So you've got Justice Thomas asking what's left of Section 542 if we interpret Section 362 in the way that you're proposing. Doesn't 542 become superfluous? Why, Justice Roberts and Thomas asked, is there no cross-reference in the statute between 362 and 542? Alito, you're saying, Judge Weedoff, that there was a significant change in 1984, and yet there's no cross-reference between the statutes that's put in place at that time. So clearly, the majority of the justices were concerned with that. They recognize there's a problem in trying to interpret 362 the way that the debtors are proposing. Nothing in Section 362 talks about automatic turnover, and yet that was the decision of the Seventh Circuit here. Final theme, I think, kind of came up at the end, but was mentioned enough times that perhaps there's something to it, or they think that there is. Well, what about Section 362A6, which is, of course, is the section that prohibits acts to collect after a bankruptcy case is filed? Justice Sotomayor talked about the college transcript cases, which I think Tom will mention in a moment here. And
well, if we had more than 30 seconds left, but go ahead.
Well, that's it. So Gorsuch talking about didn't Chicago violate Section A6 here? So it'll be interesting to see if they pick up on that theme in their decision when it comes down. Tom, you want to briefly mention?
Well, 360, the case we're talking about is mentioned in our outline, and you should read it. It's an interesting decision by Judge Easterbrook in 2009. It's mentioned on page 11, in Ray Keene, where, as I say, I tried to salvage what Frank left me after he went over and got his head chopped off by Judge Martin. That's fair, isn't it, Frank?
It's entirely fair. If there were a transcript, I would have had it expunged from the record.
Judge Easterbrook, in true fashion, he asked all the right questions of why we, representing the college, should win. You know, it was not an act and so on. But then he came up with a theory based on his reading of 19th century Wisconsin cases of why a debtor actually has a property interest in the transcript. Our opponent had not argued that. We obviously hadn't argued that, but that's now the law of the Seventh Circuit. So that brought it within 362A6 in his view, because we're now talking about, 362A3 really is now property of the estate rather than A6. I don't know. I don't know what the court's going to do. My guess is that we're going to end up back where we started with our transcript cases years ago. This is not an act. It's not an act to collect. It's not an act to this. It's not an act to do that. It's a non-act. And it seems to me that sort of simplistic view of things is probably the path of least resistance for the court to take. And let Congress change it if it wants to. Congress doesn't do anything, so it won't. So.
Interestingly, this is will be a decision by only 8 of the 9 justices. So we'll see what happens.
Could split 4-4, couldn't it? Then they'd have to rehear it with Justice Barrett participating. So we were glad to be asked to do this. We've enjoyed it. Glad to see so many of you here, and wish you the best of holidays. And if you haven't learned anything, don't blame us. It's the material.
Well, Frank and Tom, thank you both. This again was a very enjoyable event to lead us into the holidays, even under these, which are not necessarily the best of times, but this format undoubtedly allows us to reach people who may not have been able to come over to the courthouse or come over to one of the sort of dedicated alternative locations, how we've done it in the past. So quite frankly, I think maybe this reached more people than we would have even had we done it in the traditional way. So we of course miss, like always, we miss everybody being able, the people who are able to come over, we miss seeing them in person and being able to chit chat with them before and after the event. But again, we are able to reach a lot of people this way. So thank you both, and happy holidays to everybody who has been able to join us today. Thank you all.
Thanks, Judge.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Frank and Tom. Appreciate it. It was really great.